So let's read Psalm 15 and then we'll jump into a brief introduction. A Psalm of David. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? He who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. He who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbour, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend. In whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honours those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. He who does not put out his money at usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. One of the shorter psalms that I think we've covered so far. It is quite a short psalm. You may be surprised, I know David and Jenny, I think at least, have read it this morning. You may be surprised, as I was, about how much we can learn from it, even though it is a relatively short psalm. So, by way of introduction then, it's another psalm that's written by David. You'll remember from our introduction we looked at how many were written by David, lots of them. This one is a David psalm. I don't believe that we know whether or not Psalms 14 and 15 were written at the same time, but in God's planning they do sit next to each other. And actually, if you were to read Psalm 14 later, you will see that Psalm 15 stands in stark contrast against the dark background of Psalm 14. Psalm 14 starts with these words, "The fool has said in his heart," whereas Psalm 15 is about the one who desires God rather than dismisses him. Another difference between 14 and 15 is that in 14 you would read that God is with his people. That's the sentiment that runs through Psalm 14, is that God is with his people. In 15, it's more about God's people are with him. We'll come a little bit more onto that later. Those of you that can remember back about 2 years, I can't believe that we started doing these psalms 2 years ago, and a bit, I think. You may recall that this is a little throwback, actually, to Psalms 1 and 2 that showed us the way of the wicked versus the way of the godly, the righteous and the unrighteous, if you remember, between Psalms 1 and 2. Sort of the same thing again in Psalm 14 and Psalm 15. We're still in the introduction, by the way. Now, on first reading, it could, I'm sure it didn't to anyone, but on first reading it could appear like David is advocating a salvation by works position here. So the question posed is, who can dwell in your holy hill? And then it's he who does this, 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 the one that doesn't do this, this, this. So you could read it as David advocating a salvation by works position. We will see very clearly that that's not the case as we go through our headings this evening. You could also read this from verse 1, that we can only worship in one place, and that's in a tent. Well, whilst some of us do that for a week in the summer in Wales, the psalm is not advocating that the only place that we can go and abide with the Lord is in a tabernacle or a tent. We know by reading the whole Bible, and indeed just other psalms, that we're actually called to worship God throughout our days, wherever we are, and in all that we do. You may have picked up on, and we'll see as we go through, that Psalm 15 warns against flippant worship, actually, against approaching public or private worship too lightly, and also about forgetting who God is. Those themes all come across, actually, as we go through Psalm 15. I have 3 points, three headings, just normal as we go through our psalms. 3 points. I'm grateful to the normal people that we reference when we do our Bible studies for their help. 3 points. The first point for this evening is the big, important question. The big, important question. This is verse 1. Let's set the scene that might have been in David's mind as he's writing this psalm to start with. 2 Samuel chapter 6 tells us that David was the one who finally brought the Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem, you may recall. And the worship of God then occurred there. But for many years before that, it had actually been about 5 miles away in a place called Gibeon. When we understand that from 2 Samuel 6, it helps us to understand some of the terminology that David uses in this first verse about a tabernacle and a holy hill. That's referring to Jerusalem and Gibeon. So that gives us a little bit of just a background of what David had in his mind as he wrote these things. However, it's very clear that David is not at all bothered about the location of the tabernacle, or the location of the worship, who may abide in your tabernacle, who can dwell in your holy hill. He's not bothered about the where. David is bothered about the what. What should happen there, what characterizes that person that does that. I wonder whether or not, as we went through, or if I asked you the question now, what might have inspired David to write this psalm? You don't have to shout your answers out. What might have inspired David to write this short psalm? This first question, the question in the first verse, suggests that it comes from a heart, from David's heart, that longed for close friendship and intimacy with God. Comes from a heart that wanted to be in a spirit of worshipping all the time. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? So this is the big, important question. I think it's important that we then stop for 1 second and don't get caught up with this word tabernacle. And upon reading a few things, some people do. The question here could be paraphrased thus. What, Lord, are the conditions for one to enjoy close, true fellowship with you, my Lord? What are the conditions for one to enjoy close, true fellowship with you, my Lord? Or I could read you some verses from Revelation 21, which I'm going to. Revelation 21. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. This is about communion with God, not the place that one may go to do it. This is about the person that communes with God. If I pause for a second and ask you the question that I asked myself at this point, is it possible at all that any of us need this question posed to us to make us think afresh about our general attitude sometimes with which we come to God? I know sometimes that my attitude is too relaxed. So is it possible that as we read this psalm, that's a little spur for us to think about this list that we're going to come onto that characterises the person that comes to abide in the tabernacle, to abide with God in his presence? So before we move on from this first point, the big important question, a quick mention of the word dwell. This verb has the idea of settling down or living with, if you like. So this is not fly in, fly out. We use that terminology in construction a lot. If we fly into a country to do a job and then fly out, that's not what this word dwell is thinking of. This quick in, out. No, this is residing perpetually. Perpetually meaning forever. What we're going to go on to see in our next couple of points then is the importance of the heart devoted to God. So that's the first verse, the big important question. So the second point then for this evening, the answer that searches us, the answer to that question that searches us, and that's from verses 2 to the beginning of 5. The answer that searches us. I don't know if you were counting the list as we went through it, because it is a list. We have 10 conditions before us, or 10 prerequisites, if you like, for holding true fellowship with God. Now it's very, very important at this point that I emphasise, for anyone that might need it, the point that this is not a list of qualifications or achievements that grant us access into God's presence. It's not a tick list of good deeds and things that we must achieve before communing with God. Instead, when we look at these 10 conditions, what we need to be thinking of is this is the character profile for the one who is already a believer and is already a guest of the Lord. This is what God expects us to look like. That's how we should see this list of 10 things. This is what God expects us to look like if we are to answer the first question. Who abides in your tabernacle, Lord? Who can dwell in your holy hill? if it's helpful to you, think of it like the eight characteristics that we find in Matthew 5 in the Beatitudes that show us what a true disciple of Christ looks like. So, we have a list of 10 things. They're split down like this. It started with three positive traits. They're almost one line each one, a couple of them go into two lines. But we have three positive traits, we have three negative traits, then we come back to two more positive, and then a final two negative. I'm unclear on why that's the structure. I don't think it's really the point about why that's the structure, but that's what it is. Three negative, three positive, three negative, two more positive, two negative. We're going to look through them split now. So the first three positive traits, we could put a little subheading. I don't like putting too many headings into things, but we could have a little subheading that says that this is that person's tendencies. So who may abide in your tabernacle? That person's tendencies, these first three positive traits. One who, we're just going to literally go through them, who walks uprightly. So blameless. Does that mean without sin? No. Does not mean without sin. Doesn't mean that that person is perfect. We could say that this one, though, has a wholeness of character, would be one way of putting it. And one who is pursuing holiness. That's a way of thinking about walks uprightly. So that's the first positive. Second positive, works righteousness. One who works righteousness. If we unpack that a little bit, we could say that that's someone who seeks to emulate Jesus, yeah? And emulate the actions of Jesus. Doing what God would see as right and fair. So the complete opposite of a worker of iniquity, a worker of righteousness. Think of the opposite of Psalm 14. Not the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. So, positive, works righteousness. The third positive trait, speaks the truth. So that's in the last part of verse 2. Speaks the truth. Not just saying the right things, that's easy sometimes to say the right things, but really meaning them. So think of the word sincerity here. A godly person's speech, then, this verse is teaching us, a godly person's speech should, or indeed must, express what he genuinely believes. So it's the opposite of the person that we would read of in Isaiah 29, verse 13, where it says, talking about people who draw near to me with their mouths and honour me with their lips, but have removed their hearts far from me. So not that person. So we have walk uprightly, works righteousness, and speaks the truth. Three positives for the person who gets to commune with the Lord in his tabernacle. Then we come on to the first three negatives, and these could be characterised by that person's speech. So I remember when Mark Gladwell was the pastor, he used to love doing this. He said, we'll do the negatives, we'll talk about what it negatively is, and then go into the positive. So this is the negative as in what someone should not do, as opposed to what they should do, if that makes sense. So it's all still about the believer's characteristics. Characterised then by their speech. Three negatives. No backbiting with his or her tongue. No backbiting with his tongue. This is in verse 3, the beginning of verse 3. So, one who doesn't go around slandering. No malicious intent in their speech. Not telling false tales about others. James 1 tells us about the evil that the tongue is capable of. I don't want to say much more about that because I think someone might be doing a Bible study on that sometime soon. So no backbiting with his tongue. The second negative characteristic. Not evil to his neighbour. Middle of verse 3. Not evil to his neighbour. Fairly self-explanatory, I guess. So not actively hurting those around us, near us. Neighbour is not literally our direct neighbour. It's those that we are with regularly, day to day. Not actively seeking to hurt those around us. Loving our neighbour a little bit less than ourselves? No. Loving our neighbour as ourselves. Right? One of the main commands in the New Testament. The third negative then, to characterise this person who can dwell in God's tabernacle and in the holy hill. Not reproaching his friend. A little bit harder to understand if we don't use the word reproach in our everyday language, do we? I don't think. Not reproaching his friend. So that is not seeking to discredit our friends. Not mocking, not ridiculing. Another way of putting this, I think, could be to say be an encourager and build people up rather than knocking them down, not reproaching against his friend. That's the end of verse 3. So we've done the three positives, we've done the three negatives. Then we come back to two more positives, the next two lines. These could be subtitled, if you like, the affections of that one, the affections of this person who is able to abide in God's tabernacle, the affections. Verse 4, despising the vile person. Now, that doesn't mean that we look down on that person, right? Despising that person, if you sort of think about that the way the word gets used perhaps today, it doesn't mean we're looking, doesn't mean despising them like, you know, we're not looking down on that person from a lofty position of, you know, of perfection or, no. It just means we take no pleasure in their wickedness and instead we respect those who revere the Lord. That's the distinction that's being made here. Despising the vile person. And certainly not looking down on them. And then the end of verse 4, we have a promise keeper. And it's I'm going to go a little bit, a promise keeper at personal expense. A promise keeper at personal expense. This is, he honours those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. We could think of the word integrity here. Someone who maybe said something, and you're going to do something, and you are now, you're still going to do it, even though actually it's going to cost now, and it's actually really going to be... Oh. No, we said we're going to do it, you're going to do it. A promise keeper, even at personal expense. The thing that came to my mind when I was reading that is the acronym, I think it's an acronym, when J-O-Y, and then they mean something. Jesus, others, yourself. That's what came to my mind when you think about this. A promise keeper, even at personal expense. Jesus first, others second, yourself last. So that's the two extra positive traits. Then we come to the last two negative traits. The last two negative traits. And these could be subtitled, that person's contentment. So the one, this person's contentment who abides with the Lord. Two more things then in verse 5. The first one is not being motivated by financial gain. Who does not put out his money at usury. This has sentiments of lending someone money and then charging them a load of interest on it and really like making money off the poor. That's the sort of sentiment that's behind it when you look at the original language. So not motivated by financial gain. We could also say that's using money wisely as well as not taking advantage of others. Remember the poor and the needy. Galatians 6, verse 10. As we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. So using what we've been gifted with wisely and not being motivated by financial gain. And then the last, this is the tenth characteristic or trait of this one who may abide in the Lord's tabernacle and in his holy hill, is not being corrupt. Kind of sounds fairly obvious, right? That we wouldn't want to be corrupt in the sense that, you know, we talk about corrupt MPs or whatever. It kind of makes sense. But actually there's little subtleties there that could even creep into anything that we do about our mindset, about being corrupt. Things that come to my mind are, you know, those times where you start talking about paying VAT and stuff like that. You know, not being corrupt. God is righteous and he expects us to be upright. So again, there's a sense of fairness and looking out for our fellow brothers and sisters coming across here. Does not take a bribe against the innocent. When I was reading up about this, the sort of the thinking around the language in the original of this is about one who would have gone to try and pay off a judge to actually get their own way in a particular setting. So not being corrupt, having a sense of fairness and looking out for our fellow brothers and sisters. I know I've gone through that fairly quickly, but that the 10 conditions then, the 10 character traits that characterise, that sum up this person who may abide in the Lord's tabernacle and dwell in his holy hill. So that's the answer that searches us. That was the second point, if you're trying to keep up. The third point, final point, for a brief conclusion, is the assuring promise. the assuring promise, which is the last part of verse 5. He who does these things shall never be moved.
Put simply, the one who displays these 10 characteristics then will not be moved. That is, this one, who's characterized by these 10 traits, will know the stability of belonging to God's kingdom. And that is God's kingdom that will not pass away and that cannot fail. That this person who's characterized by these 10 things can reside in God's tabernacle and is a permanent guest there. Sounds quite nice, doesn't it? I think it's a guest there. You're a permanent guest, stable in God's never-ending, never-failing kingdom. Did you notice? I hadn't noticed it. Did you notice then that this answer at the very end there, this assuring promise, that the answer to the question in verse 1 goes beyond the question? Well, let me explain what I mean. The answer goes beyond the question. The question simply says, who may abide? So this is about communion with God. Who can commune with God? The answer goes further. It doesn't just say, well, this one. It then goes on to say, and that one is secure. You will abide, and you will be held tightly in God's grip. Does that make sense? Not just, oh, this one can abide. No, no. In addition, you'll be secure, and I'll keep hold of you. How typical of the loving Father that we have to go beyond what was asked, what we asked, or what we can even imagine. The answer to the question is answered, and then some. So that's the assuring promise. 2 minutes of conclusion, and then we'll come to our prayer time. So we have here a very short psalm, but it is, I think, both encouraging, but also quite challenging. It's encouraging that God desires our communion, right? That's encouraging. God wants our presence with Him. He wants our nearness to Him. And one of the books I was reading about this said, think about where the tabernacle sat, where it was set up in the tent. It was right in the middle of everyone's tent. The Lord wanted to be with the people. So this is encouraging that God wants our communion. He wants us to be near Him. And He wants to be near us. But it's challenging as well, isn't it? Because we must not take that fact lightly. We shouldn't take that, we should be flippant about that, and we should be seeking to please Him and honour Him then, to be the one characterised by these 10 things. Will you forgive me quoting a very, very old, two verses from, I think it's a poem rather than a hymn, from an old Church of England bishop, I think it dates back to 1805. Bishop Edward Bickersteth. Do you know? It was unknown to me.
I've never met him.
No. But you recognise the name. Bishop Edward Bickersteth. If you'll forgive the old English, but let me read this in words. Not worthy, Lord, to gather up the crumbs with trembling hands that from thy table fall. A weary, heavy-laden sinner comes to please thy promise and obey thy call. Second verse. I am not worthy to be thought thy child, nor sit the last and lowest at thy board, as I think. Too long a wanderer, and too oft beguiled, I only ask one reconciling word. So may this psalm then, that's been brief, and we've only spent a few minutes looking at it, may this psalm be either reassuring to us, or indeed restorative to us as we ponder it after the season.